Hey, hey, what do you know? What do you say? Let's talk about some rock and roll today. This is the Rolling Stone Hour, where we read some of the articles from the Rolling Stone magazine and talk about the music scene. Let us slam it and get on with the life of rock and roll, huh? All right, ladies and germs. As you know, last week we cracked open the new issue of the Rolling Stone, issue 1345. And I've been reading through it, and just a lot of good stories, and they're wonderful stories. And, of course, we haven't finished with the prior Rolling Stone with the top 500 albums, but we'll see if we can get to that a little later. But I'm going to start off with The Last Word. It's the last written page in the magazine, and they're interviewing David Byrne, the legendary singer on Embracing Nonsense and Owning His Mistakes. He was asked initially, "How have you been handling quarantine?" And he says, "Probably like many other people, I have worked on my cooking skills. Cooking, for one, is," then she pauses. "Yeah, that sounds like a country song, but here we go. I've been cooking for one. Some of the dishes are really good, and some of them are real failures, but nobody needs to know that." He was asked, "What do you do when you want to relax?" He says, "I go for a bike ride. I've been soliciting others, friends and band members, to join me. We go to Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, wherever, and just explore different neighborhoods. You're not just sitting there. You're seeing a new neighborhood and a place that you don't know anything about, expanding your view of the place where you live, understanding it a little bit better. It's really nice." Then he was asked, "What did you learn from working with Spike Lee on your new American Utopia movie?" And he says, "One of the things I've learned from him, which is something I've been learning myself over the years, is how he has this incredible enthusiasm when he's working. He's excited about what the camera people are doing, the actors, the band, all the stuff that's going on. He's just totally energized by all of it. And that's infectious and makes everybody else do a better job." Then he was asked, "You performed Janelle Monáe's 2015 protest song, Hell You Tell 'Em About, in the show, and you and the band say the names of African Americans who have been unjustly killed. What does it mean to you to be a good ally?" And he says, "I've learned that we have a poison within us, all of us, and I think it's important to realize that I'm not immune to it. None of us are. Then we have to work through it and try to reject this poison, and we have to get it out of our bodies. But you can't just will it to go away. It's work. It can maybe take a lifetime." Then he was asked, "You recently acknowledged that in the 80s you wore black and brown face in a Talking Heads promo clip, and you apologized for it. What did you take away from that experience of people bringing that to your attention?" And he says, "I kind of completely forgotten about it, and I thought, oh, God, look at this, how times have changed and how much I've changed. But I thought, okay, I'm going to put this apology out there, and I'm not going to make it a big deal, but I'm going to talk about it and own this and hope that people can understand that I've grown and changed since then. But as I said, it's an ongoing process, and to the credit, people have accepted my apology. I think they feel that I did this in the right way by putting that out there." And then he was asked, "Your song, Every Day is a Miracle, has stuck with me since watching American Utopia. How do you go about waking up every day feeling that way every day?" And he says, "I have to grab that feeling when it's happening. There are certain mornings where I wake up and I'll read a few newspapers online and I'll often feel very depressed or despondent. Other times I'll go, no, look, I've got things I've got to do today. And sometimes they're mental things, but that's okay. So I just kind of get on with it." And then he was asked, "The nonsense lyrics to Talking Heads' I, Zimbra, are the distich poem by Hugo Ball. How do you know when it's time to stop making sense?" And he says, "Never. My daughter has a young child, and I am proud that I have shown him how to work a salad spinner with his head. Okay. And then he was asked, it seems that a lot of your fans dwell on talking heads. What advice do you have for moving on? And he says, I realize it's not about me. People who experienced that music at that point in their lives, it was very formative. It's not about, can I write a song as good as some Talking Head song? I know I can, but for those people, you never, ever are going to beat that. And that's not failing on my part or the songwriter's part. It's just life. And finally, he was asked, what advice would you give to your younger self? And he says, don't worry about your personal life. It'll all work out. Okay, interview there with David Burns, legendary singer and on embracing nonsense and owning his own mistakes. All right. Okay, we're jumping back one magazine and talking about the top 500. And so we got up to 20. No, 21, I stand corrected. We got up to 21 with the last time we talked about it. And we'll go on to number 22, which is Ready to Die by the Notorious B.I.G., released by Bad Boy in 1994. Biggie spread the love the Brooklyn way on his historic debut, introducing us to most immediately likable voice in hip-hop history. I made the record for New York, but I wanted the world to hear it, Biggie said. Ready to Die, executive producer Sean Puffy Combs, who had read about the fledgling Brooklyn rapper in Source magazine, pushed his new discovery to leveling up the stick-up kid, self-mythologizing machine gun funk, and Give Me the Loot, which inviting party up pop like Big Papa, and the ecstatically playful origin story Juicy. But it was Biggie's gift of gab and enormous personality that made Ready to Die so wonderful. Whether he was offering a complex vision of the mean streets of Fort Greene on Things Done Changed, kicking it Bonnie and Clyde style on Me and My Bitch, or delivering rags-to-riches brags like Birthday in the Worst Days, Now We Skip Champagne When We're Thirsty. In the process, he remade rap in his image. As with Kurt Cobain, his tragic death while still in his 20s will always leave us wondering how far in this 90s legend may have gone. That's quite true. Okay, it's 12 seconds past 10:30, and you are listening to the Rolling Stone Hour here on Mind's Eye, the virtual newsstand, and I am your reader, Alan Newsham, and I want to thank you all for listening in this evening. I hope you're seated comfortably and enjoying the program so far. And, of course, as always, we like to ask for you to give us a call. Let us know what's going on. Our phone number here is area code 618-394-6444. And you can call, leave a message, and someone will get back to you on that. But you can also send us an email to mindseye@mindseyeradio.org and let us know what you think. And if you have any questions or comments or criticisms about this program or any of the other programs here on Mind's Eye, we sure would like to hear from you because we want to provide the best music for you. We want to provide a service that you find valuable. And if you're not feeling that way, we want to find out why and what we can do to make it better. Okay? Give us a call, 636. No, it isn't. It's 618-394-6444 or mindseye@mindseyeradio.org. Okay, we're back. Number 23 on the top 500 list is The Velvet Underground and Nico. And that was released by Verve in 1967. Much of what we take for granted in rock and world now exists, would not exist without this new New York band debut. The androgynous sexuality of glam, punk's raw noir, the all-black noir of goth, Lou Reed demonstrated carnal desire and drug addiction with pop wisdom, bassist John Cale, added Pulse and Drone. Nico, a German vocalist brought on by manager Andy Warhol, added an icy femininity. Rejected as nihilistic by the Love crowd in 1967, it's the most prophetic rock album ever made. And it's the album that had a banana peel on the front, and you could peel it off, and many people did and threw it away, and then just that kind of ruined the cost or the worth of the album. And if you find one with a pink banana skin on it, apparently it's the big deal. So it's top dollar for that one, indeed. Okay, number four, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Now, that would have been number one for me. But the Beatles' most ambitious and imaginative album, Sgt. Pepper's, christened the Summer of Love with a lavish psychedelic daydream. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, the jaunty Ringo Starr sung Communality album, with a little help from my friends, and the multi-layered masterwork of A Day in the Life. Goes on here that we were fed up with being the Beatles, recalls Paul McCartney, who came up with the idea of dropping alter egos for the project. It's liberating. It's liberating to you, he said. I could do anything. Well, I imagine you could. And another oldie but goodie, number 25, is Tapestry by Carole King, released in 1971. For a decade, Carole King wrote pop songs with her then-husband, Gary Goffin. Then King's friend, James Taylor, encouraged her to sing her own tunes. She slowed down Will You Love Me Tomorrow, a hit from the Shirelles in 1961, heightening the melancholy inside while her warmth, earning struggles, brought out the sadness in her life, too, such as It's Too Late and the joy of I Feel the Earth Move. The resulting set of songs saw King remake herself as an artist, selling millions and creating the reigning model for the 1970s female singer-songwriter. All right. And speaking of Patti Smith, number 26, Horses by Patti Smith, released by Arista in 1975. From its first defiant line, Jesus died for somebody's sins but not for mine, the opening shot, in a bold reinvention of Van Morrison's garage rock classic Gloria, Patti Smith's debut LP was a declaration of mutiny. Horses made her the queen of punk, but Smith cared more for the poetry and rock. She thought the visions and passions that connected Keith Richards and Rimbaud and found him with the intuitive assistance of a killer band led by guitarist Lenny Kaye, and her friend Robert Mapplethorpe, who shot the iconic cover portrait. Okay, and the list seems to go on forever and ever and ever, but see, 27 through 31. First one is Enter the Wu-Tang, or 36 Chambers. We have number 27, Enter the Wu-Tang, and like we said, 36 Chambers. According to Wu-Tang Mastermind RZA, the Staten Island crew incorporated aspects of Eastern philosophy picked up from Kung Fu movies, watered-down Nations of Islam preaching picked up on the New York street, and comic books. Their raw, hectic debut landed them rap's greatest franchise and reassorted New York's hip-hop dominance in the field in the early 90s. Number 38 is D'Angelo's Voodoo, released by EMI in 2000. D'Angelo's 1995 debut, Brown Sugar, brought in a lived-in funkiness to modern R&B. 5 years later, on Voodoo, he blew past the genre altogether. Voodoo felt at once old-school and futuristic, setting Pink Floyd-style cosmic jams like the Playa Players next to Prince-inspired erotica like Untitled, How Does It Feel? I'm just looking at voodoo as just the beginning, D'Angelo said. It took for a while, but I'm on my way up now. Okay. And then one I thought this should have been number two is actually number 29 on the top 100 list, and it's The Beatles, The White Album. They didn't appear on any of the covers because they were breaking apart. But that tension fueled a creative high point. The childlike yearnings of John Lennon's Julia, Paul McCartney's playful inversion of Chuck Berry's American Values back in the USSR, George Harrison's longing on While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and Ringo Starr's Don't Pass Me By, his first original on a Beatles album. How about that, huh? But that's at 29. Number 30, Are You Experienced by Jimi Hendrix, which was released in 1967. This is what Britain sounded like in late 1966 and early 1967, ablaze with rainbow blues and cosmic possibilities. Jimi Hendrix's incendiary guitar howl was historic in itself, but it was the pictorial heat of the songs like Manic Depression and the Wind Cries Mary that the establishment of transcendent promise of psychedelia. It's a collection for free feeling and imagination, he said. And finally, Kind of Blues, number 31, Miles Davis, released by Columbia in 1959. The painterly masterpiece is one of the most important, influential, and popular jazz albums. It's Kind of Blue was also a revolution all its own. Turning his back on established chord progressions, the trumpeter Miles Davis used modal scales as a starting point for composition and improvisation, breaking new grounds with warmth, subtlety, and understanding of the thickness of hard bop. Well, I agree with that, and wish I could have seen him in action. So we'll read a couple more next week if we can get to it. In the meantime, if you would rather I not, if you would like me to quit and move on to something else, well, we can do that too. But God willing and the creek don't rise, next week we will go over, the 32, 33, 34, and maybe 35 and 36 too. So we'll see what goes on with that. Okay, then we move to the mix area of the magazine. What's new? What's next? What's news? And we come to a young lady, Amy Lee, gets back to life. Struck at home, she's burning her way through a long-awaited Evanescence ceremony or album. Okay? And goes on to say, Amy Lee, Mrs. Brooklyn. She lived there for 12 years with her husband and later their son, born in 2015, before they left their apartment for Nashville a year ago. The perfect year, she says with an eye roll over Zoom. Lee had hoped to be closer to her family in Arkansas and friends in Nashville when she moved, only to find herself stuck at home like the rest of the world. We haven't gotten in to see people as much as we would have liked to because of COVID, but now we're here, we'll be set up for a better next year, she says optimistically. That's not the only plan she had to readjust earlier. This year, her alt-metal band, Evanescence, returned to the studio with producer Rick Raskolnicki. Writing and recording songs for what will be their first album of new material since 2011's Evanescence. While the pandemic slowed them down, the group has forged onward, working remotely at first and later, after getting negative COVID tests at Nashville Studio. I'm not going to rush, says Lee, age 38. I'm just trying to live in the moment, feeding my soul with the music. This spring, Evanescence debuted their sobering power ballad, Wasted on You, as the first release from their very much in progress LP, The Bitter Truth. Since April, when her U.S.-based bandmates took tour buses to join her in Nashville, guitarist Jen Majura has remained in Germany, they've been powering through the rest of the album. The energy was just amped, Lee says. We were in there on fire, and now the guys are back at their homes, and I'm wading through the aftermath of all this music, piecing it together and finalizing the record. In some ways, she says, lockdown has been a blessing. The upset of this time is that I've had to buckle down and focus even on the days that I didn't want to come out here, and I go, let's do this. Let's finish this album. The near decade leading up to The Bitter Truth has been both eye-opening and invigorating for Lee. After the release of Evanescence, the group went on hiatus while dealing with legal dispute with its former label. Lee took some time to work on solo projects, including a children's album. When the band got back to the studio, it was to reimagine past hits with orchestral arrangements for the 2017 LP Synthesis. Those changes, among others, mean that The Bitter Truth will be the group's first album of new material with the current lineup. The band has changed sufficiently since Lee formed Evanescence as a duo with guitarist Ben Moody in 1995, the year that they met at a Christian youth camp in Little Rock when she was 13. Lee, whose father worked in the radio business, had grown up loving Motown before seeing Amadeus and falling for classical music. I wanted to be like Mozart, she says. I begged for piano lessons. I got to take the piano lessons. Then grunge hit. Soon she was deep into rock radio of the day, like teens all across America listening to Nirvana and Soundgarden and Tori Amos and Beck. It was the same time she was writing poetry and thinking about the connections between her favorite sounds. It just all fell together, she says. The heavier the music, the more was in the Metallica Pantera world, the more similarities I could draw with Bach and Beethoven. Evanescence signed their first record deal in the late 90s, when Lee was just 19 and starting out to study theory composition at Middle Tennessee State University. It took a few independent EPs and a jump to a major label for the duo to become a full band, and enlisting a few friends for their first full-length label release, 2003's Fallen. The LP became one of the year's hugest commercial successes, going platinum seven times over and making them instant peers to Beyoncé, Christina Aguilera, Norah Jones, and Avril Lavigne. Bring Me to Life, its thrashing thunderstorm of a lead single, became an enduring goth pop album, and with follow-up, My Immortal, is not far behind. In 2004, Grammys Evanescence took home the Best New Artist trophy, beating out 50 Cent and Sean Paul, and Fallen was nominated for Album of the Year, or lost it to Outkast, Unstoppable Speaker Box 3, the Love Below. Behind the scenes, though, success proved difficult for Evanescence to handle. It was weird, Lee says now. I grew up in public. She was surprised that an album so informed by real-life darkness included the tragic death of her sister when they were both young kids could yield top 10 hits. We were bound rock band kids at the Grammys of the American Music Awards or whatever, rubbing elbows with the pop and all the stars of the day, she adds. When we won, I felt like somebody was going to jump out from behind and surprise us and go, just kidding, losers, you don't belong here at all. I spent Evanescence's first major tour worrying about an ailing brother and tensions in the band between had boiled over between Moody's dramatic departure halfway through 2003's trek across Europe. He's never returned to the band. I remember lots of times just wanting to go home, Lee says. I was the only female around for miles, and I felt alone in my band and on the road. Every rock era has been defined by how few women have been able to break through the mainstream, and Lee felt isolated as her operatic mezzo-soprano became one of rock's distinctive voices. At one radio show, Lee remembers a DJ introduced the band by admitting that he had jacked off on the Fallen album, the Fallen album cover, a close-up of Lee's face after the first song and the first few minutes of the Summery Range. Lee called him out. At another show, she interrupted her performance to confront a fan trying to get the mostly male audience to chant, "Show your tits." It took until this year for Lee to feel comfortable expressing her opinion on politics, speaking out in interviews against Donald Trump and the police killing of George Floyd. On Use My Voice, released as a single this summer, she makes it clear she's no longer willing to stay quiet. "Drown every truth in an ocean of lies," she sings. "Label me bitch because I dared to draw my own line. Burn every bridge and build a wall in my way, but I will use my voice." Evanescence recorded the song with backing vocalists including Hailstrom's Izzy Hale and Pretty Reckless Taylor Momsen, two leading voices in hard rock who told Lee she's been a major influence on their careers. "That started giving me life," Lee says. "It made me pour myself into it with a new sense of understanding and purpose and confidence in what I was saying was worth hearing." Amen, sister. Here's some fast facts about Lee. She heard it through the grapevine. The first album that Lee ever bought was by the California Raisins, lending her voice. "Using My Voice," quote-unquote, was originally inspired by Chanel Miller's story told in the book Know My Name, On the Rise. Lee had her Brooklyn neighborhood mail her a sourdough starter while isolating in Nashville. How about that? That sounds pretty cool. Okay, we got some album reviews to do. And the first one is a new album by Paul McCartney. And it's called Paul McCartney 3, issued under Capitol, and it's given 4 out of 5 stars by the Rolling Stone. It says, "Paul gets back to the country. McCartney returns to the pastoral sound of his early solo work for a laid-back gem." Every decade should kick off with a Paul McCartney one-man band album, and this one needs it more than most. McCartney 3 carries on his tradition of homemade solo albums, solo records, in the mode of his acoustic 1970 debut and his 1980 synth-pop oddity, McCartney 2. Like its two predecessors, it's Macca at his most playful. He's not sweating about being a legend, a genius, or a Beatle. Just a family man kicking back in quarantine, writing a few songs to keep his juices flowing. It's the warmest and friendliest of quarantine albums. It's basically Rahm meets folklore. Like the rest of us, Mac has been in lockdown, hanging out on the farm with his daughter, grandchildren on his knees, strumming his acoustic guitar in the English summer sun. He wrote, played, and produced nearly all of McCartney 3, full of his folksy finger-picking. Back in the 70s, one of his Wings bandmates called him just a farmer who plays a guitar. And that is the vibe he's going for here. Paul hasn't sounded so rustic since his earliest solo days, from Mary Had a Little Lamb to Mull of Kintyre. When he sings about sheep and chicken, you know he means actual sheep and chickens, not metaphors. I want to thank you for inviting me into your home again this evening, even though I've warned you. Come on back next week and we'll rock and roll again.